Welcome to Dark Woods, a Twin Peaks podcast. Hello, this is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And joining us this week for a very special episode is...
Nathan Smith.
Woo! Thank you for joining us, Nathan. Well, before we get on to this hour, Nathan, maybe you can tell us what do you think of the return so far?
I have really been enjoying it so far. I think it's probably I don't know. I feel like most movie people on the internet, my relationship with television is kind of complicated, and so it's I have watched a lot of TV, but I don't really, I guess, keep a running catalog of like the best episodes that I've ever seen or anything like that. I don't feel really like the most equipped person to talk about TV as a medium, but I feel like Twin Peaks: The Return is one of the best things that I've seen on TV ever, excepting probably like the first season of The OC. And a couple episodes of The Sopranos.
Where do you stand on the fourth season of The OC?
I am a defender of the fourth season of The OC. You know, they realize that Marissa was just holding it down, you know, that she was just the dead weight, and so they got weird, and I appreciated that. You know, the like alien rave episode in the desert, that's a classic. So I have basically kind of been on board with most of the show so far. I'm not one of the people who have gotten frustrated with the Dougie Jones plot. I mean, you know, not the first person to make this comparison, but really like the Tati-esque nature, I guess, of that story arc. This episode is kind of pretty obviously a challenge to talk about, and I feel like it, you know, we've seen these things before in Lynch's work and in this show so far in this season, but not compacted like it is in this episode. So,
well, I mean, I think we can say about this episode or hour titled Got a Light, you mentioned TV as an artwork, art form. I mean, I think I at least can say this is unlike anything I've ever seen on television. Would we all agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know under what circumstances there would be another answer. I mean, I would really like to know under what circumstances there are another answer to that question.
I haven't watched The Young Pope yet, so.
No, me neither.
So, I mean, if we want to sum up what happens in this, if you had to sum up what happens in this episode in one sentence, what would that sentence be?
Well, I was thinking about this, as a matter of fact. I would say Alpha Coop is shot, and perhaps killed, and perhaps resurrected. And from that, there emerges a rift in Twin Peaks' space-time continuum. Semicolon. Further, it is an opportunity for us to perhaps, parenthetical M dash, perhaps, and parenthetical M dash, witness the birth of the Black Lodge. How's that?
I think that's pretty good. I mean, you forgot to add the period at the end, but
oh, period.
Okay. Well, don't forget, I think you can say that Nine Inch Nails maybe summons the rift in the universe as well.
The
quotation marks.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, I think the comparison, I mean, this episode, you can say pretty safely, it turned Twitter inside out, basically. And we've gotten comparisons to avant-garde artists. We've gotten comparisons to Kubrick and Malick. I mean, I personally gravitate towards the latter just because I'm not as well versed in experimental cinema beyond really Brakhage and James Benning. So I feel like, because this, the difference I think is that this episode does essentially serve a narrative purpose, as experimental as it is formally. It does, you know, it may actually do the most for the mythology, or even tell the most story of any episode so far, if that makes any sense.
No, I think that completely makes sense, just because, if I'm not wrong, I feel like this is kind of the first ever big real flashback kind of episode on Twin Peaks. I can't remember anything else like it. I didn't refresh myself on the show before this season, so I may be forgetting something, but I don't really feel like there's anything else really like this. Am I wrong? Am I right in saying that? Has there?
I'd agree. In fact, when I was making notes in this episode, I actually called it the cosmic firewalk with me.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think, too, one of the things that I was noticing, as I feel like it's maybe the most tonally consistent episode so far this season, mm-hmm. Just because it kind of, it wildly shifts in location and in time, but it's pretty a kind of solid wavelength, I think, and you know, the pure heroin Lynch kind of for all 60 minutes, and there's no comic relief, and there's, you know, none of the gags that we've been seeing over the past few episodes. It just kind of, it goes continuously, I feel like.
To be fair, Ray's response to shooting Alpha Coop was quite funny, along the lines of, he's dead, I think. That was, that was pretty special.
I believe he also had the line, maybe this will let us figure out this whole thing. It's the key to this whole thing.
Yes, absolutely. No, I think I found, I mean, maybe to jump off of what you're saying, Nathan, I think I did find something humorous in the particularly abstract experimental section, mm-hmm. but perhaps in a more abstract way. Of watching it and laughing to myself along the lines of, well, A, he's actually doing this. B, he is actually allowed to do this. C, this is in fact airing on premium cable on a Sunday night at 9. To that extent, I did find it humorous, or let's be a bit more exact and say amusing and appreciative mm-hmm. in that way. And yet, the musical accompaniment is Threnody to the Victims of Hiroshima. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. By Penderecki.
Yes, by Penderecki, which I think is ample enough evidence that he's not exactly going for laughs here. And the sort of more narrative sequences that follow it, of which there is, I think, a respectable enough amount, are pretty grim in a lot of ways. The very stark black and white images, the fact that it's this representation of the 1950s in which seemingly six people exist, where you have a mechanic shop, and you have a diner, which are two classic Twin Peaks locations, and then you have the radio station, all occupied by at most two individuals who either drop dead or are subjected to some sort of skull contracting operation of some kind from an otherworldly creature. And I was enjoying myself through it. I think I am less abjectly over the moon than everybody else is, but that's not necessarily a slight against it. It's more that the response to it was so OMG, 3 exclamation points from a lot of people. I definitely enjoyed myself, although as someone whose experience with avant-garde cinema is admittedly limited, I find that often my response to works along these lines comes down to, this is pretty cool. And granted, there's a bit more being communicated there than there's a bit more narrative information being unspooled there, though I wonder if that's more by virtue or perhaps even your perspective by dint of the fact that this is part of a huge, massive narrative project in that way. But yeah, watching it, I mean, were you guys sort of asking yourself how much longer this could possibly go on? Because I have to say, I found myself looking at the television, or sorry, the cable box clock when the June 16th, 1945 card came up. Because I was asking myself, okay, we're about, 17 minutes into this episode and we're getting down to this. So where could we possibly be going for the rest of this? And then 45 minutes in, we're kind of still doing it. It was just kind of this totalizing experience in that way, in a way that I appreciated. Even if I have maybe a certain quibble, ambivalence about it, which we can get to in a minute, I'd like to hear your response just to kind of the boy he about to do it aspect of this.
I didn't watch this last night. I wasn't able to, and so I watched it this morning, and so I feel like seeing that hype machine get going and like seeing that the primary response be a just like the OMG, like, wow, you know, he really did it factor that you're talking about, like, that obviously kind of impacted my experience with it. And so I don't think that I'm as hot on it just like of itself either. I think all of the extra textual stuff and all of the, like, this is actually a thing that was put onto television and piped into people's homes, I think that, like, is just one of those cases where it has kind of already in the day that since this has come out made it hard to really talk about. And then B, kind of on the other hand, I feel like a lot of people are really grasping for, you know, these same reference points of, like, you know, for lack of a better word, just like out there narrative, abstract narrative cinema. And I do definitely see similarities to a lot of the reference points that are being talked about. You know, there's one segment that really looks like Stan Brakhage's Black Ice, but I kind of don't think that discussion really gets us anywhere. And so seeing that just start immediately before I watched the episode kind of impacted how I watched it. And I did find myself starting to drift a little bit during the convenience store sequence. Just because it really goes on. But overall, it's like I still can't get, I you know, even though I was kind of complaining about this response, it's like I can't get away from the, like, this is a thing that happened. And it's, so it's hard to, you know, I watched it again, like, pretty soon after, and I still don't know how to really approach it. So I understand the you know, everyone's immediate kind of reaching out for some kind of reference point and focusing on the fact that this happened rather than, like, what is it that happened?
Peter Deming, the cinematographer of the show, posted, I think, something on Instagram being like, episode 8, like no other. I also think there was an Entertainment Weekly writer who said on Twitter, I've got some sources saying this is a pretty wild episode, and there have been some hype building, essentially, you can say. And
why is that your default voice for the Entertainment Weekly writer? Sort of a cattle rancher?
It is based in Wyoming, isn't it? My mind was racing. I was thinking, okay, this is going to be maybe entirely in the Black Lodge. Who knows what's going to happen? Maybe it'll be a musical episode. Who the heck knows? But, this episode begins just with a kind of very classical shot, Cooper and Ray in the car. And then, once it got to what you could say is the interdimensional hobos, I was kind of like, oh boy. But almost, I'll admit, when I actually got the full that DMX feeling is when it played the Nine Inch Nails performance in full, I actually really did start to get that special feeling that this episode really was just going to be a progression of moods. Because, if you think of the functions of the other musical performances in the show, essentially they just sort of either ease us out or, in the case of Lynch's Son's Band, kind of are intercut. Comment on the action. The fact that this played out in full as this felt like a very kind of, it had this evil energy to it, and it helps too that it's my favorite band, so I felt a little vindicated. But, and then once it cut from that to, yes, 1945, yeah. But there is too kind of another rupture. I feel like once it does cut back to New Mexico, maybe just because there's that kind of violence in it, it changes a little. We should note the actor who plays the spirit is an Abraham Lincoln impersonator. And because I remember when he appeared on the cast list, everyone was speculating that possibly Abraham Lincoln would be in this new season, but. It's still wholly possible this character, there's more to be found out about.
But, and what is one of the first interactions, person-to-person interactions after the crazy sequence? Yeah. Someone finds a penny.
Yeah. I think something that's interesting, too, is there's been the Malick and Kubrick comparisons. I could be wrong, but I think Lynch actually stated he didn't like The Tree of Life. I seem to remember there being an interview with him where someone asked him about recent movies, and they said, oh, do you see The Tree of Life? And he's like, oh, not really my cup of tea or something. So maybe just more the impressionistic 1950s domestic stuff is not his cup of tea, but The Birth of the Universe is. Though you think he would be into 1950s domestic life, but I don't know.
For me, though, I already tweeted something to this effect, so I'm just reusing old material. But to me, I the first thing in my mind was just Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Hell yeah.
Because honestly, that was kind of the feeling I got from the town where ostensibly, as Nick, you said, like only six people are living in the 1950s. I got this feeling of like, this is just a nuclear town where a few people happen to have somehow survived or just live here. And I don't know. I still, the convenience store thing, I wonder if that has some connection to this town, because that is still the sequence that kind of sticks out for me, and doesn't, I don't know, I just can't, I get the its importance in the mythology of the show, but it just it really baffles me.
That was one of the few sequences where I actually did think possibly my stream was glitching.
Yeah, me too. And that's kind of happened a lot on this season so far, but it just kept going, all the years of the convenience store, just all these people going by.
Well, do we want to maybe talk about how this actually does specifically advance the mythology? To start, it does somewhat posit that the giant, again credited as ? is potentially God.
I mean, would you assign the big G-O-D to the giant? Or is he a sort of omniscient deity-like figure? I don't know.
He does create life.
He has a hand in creating life, I would say.
And, well, we should mention, too, I think one of the most striking images of this entire episode is the events we just saw being played back then on a cinema screen in what I believe may have been Club Silencio.
No, apparently it actually is. This is what I've read.
Holy shit. But there's something that's a thread I'm curious to see play out, the idea of cinema existing in this other dimension. I mean, people were trying to read the glass box in the first episode as a metaphor for television. Who knows, maybe there's something to that. But it's interesting how, yeah, that is already manifesting in this show, the metatextual element.
And it, you know, just that whole sequence, which has been a through line, I feel like, through a lot of these episodes. You have this very Eraserhead setting with to me at least felt, maybe just because I watched it in the past couple weeks, but really felt like Inland Empire, the scene in the theater towards the end of that movie. It felt just from kind of the framing perspective, it felt constructed very much like that scene when Laura Dern watches what's happened.
I mean, also, I think I brought up previously that it seemed like some of the stuff involving electricity was Lynch doing concepts from his Ronnie Rocket script. Mm-hmm. And this is really, too, where he's touching on that, because I guess spoilers for an unmade movie, but the ending of Ronnie Rocket, the screenplay at least, it ends with essentially the universe collapsing and then being reborn. So this seems like him touching on a cosmic dimension that I guess he hasn't actually done since Dune. In fact, I actually thought the giant levitating sort of reminded me of the Paul Atreides kind of surreal sequences, if you remember the kind of his own becoming one with the universe sequence in Dune. So there really is everything from the Lynch filmography in this.
I really hope that he's not, you know, capital G God, but it's like at the same time I feel like this episode in any other filmmaker's hand would have been insanely heavy-handed, saying that, you know, this kind of mythic evil came from the detonation of the atomic bomb. Feels very, I don't know, much more statement-y than I'm used to from Lynch, but because it's filtered through all that abstraction, it's at least easier for me to take. And so I imagine if the giant does end up being a deity figure, that I will probably be okay with it. But just that, I don't know, thinking about that in my mind, I'm just like, that idea kind of turns me off.
Yeah, so the ambivalence that I had referenced kind of comes in here. Maybe not 100% that, but for me, it's more a thing of if this is in fact the creation of Bob, the Black Lodge, et al. I mean, it is a pretty interesting way to tell that story and to create that inception point, to show that inception point. There is also part of me that just doesn't care where it comes from or doesn't want to know where it comes from, I guess. But even then, could you mine a really clear step-by-step biological answer as to what is going on? Because there is the sort of mercury plasma figure who vomits out a stream of mercury plasma substance and Bob's face already appears in it fully formed, right? So where exactly is that coming from? I couldn't tell you precisely. Perhaps the two worlds, the between two worlds, the dimensions were ripped open or conjoined, rather, in that moment, which, you know, is fine. I guess I just don't need to know that myself. So I'm hoping that this is about as far as we go on that front. Just, you know, I don't think we need to go much further than where we are, because it's already strange enough and already interesting mm-hmm. enough to not require a second step. I also wonder, maybe part of me is a little worried that it is leaning towards, you know, it's weird because I've been thinking about how Laura Palmer is so much more than just a murder victim. Her death in Firewalk With Me opens some kind of hole in the ground, basically, where it leads to this whole investigation, what have you, that leads to this unraveling of a secret cult, interdimensional creatures, that leads to Agent Cooper being trapped in the Black Lodge, porous boundaries between time and space, et cetera, et cetera. And so, yeah, her death is obviously much more than just one person dying, but her face appearing in the golden orb had me wondering, not with total positivity, as to where they could go with that or what they're implying with that, because I wonder if that's maybe making a little too much of it, if that makes sense. Sort of a, you know, it's, again, it's this thing where there's already kind of enough there for me in terms of the significance of her death and the mm-hmm. mythological underpinnings, the mythological qualities of it. So, you know, it's like, okay, golden orb goes specifically to the Pacific Northwest.
I think you mean Dragon Ball, Nick.
Dragon Ball, yes, thank you. Yeah, I don't know how you guys, I mean, Nathan, you kind of got at this, but maybe Ethan, how you feel about a certain ground being established, a certain base being established in these moments?
Yeah, I'm not sure quite how I feel about the idea of her being the good sent to Earth to combat evil. I agree, that's something I'm a little worried about, though. I still trust Lynch and Frost with it. But there was something I felt, even just putting it as an image in and of itself, referring to the lore of Dragon Ball, is her, of course, her prom portrait, which we see at the beginning of every episode of The Return and at the end of every episode of the original, appearing in that. There's something just about that image. I find it hard to quite explain, that I found very powerful. I mean, I can't remember who posted it on Twitter today, but someone posted a screen cap comparison of Cheryl Lee in Wild at Heart as the Good Witch in the giant orb. Then, of course, Laura Palmer in this, in the orb, or rather the Dragon Ball. So I'm not quite sure, but
I don't think I really need the David Lynch Prometheus. or maybe I do. I don't know. That actually sounds kind of amazing. Yeah. But yeah, it's like I'm in agreement with you, Nick. I feel a little apprehensive and weird about the potential of endowing Laura Palmer with this, you know, predestined mythic importance. But I also can't imagine at all that's what he would be going for, just, you know, since everything established about Laura Palmer beforehand would, I feel like, kind of undercut the notion of, you know, her being some kind of savior for Earth or whatever against Bob. And one of the things that I like about Twin Peaks so much, and just Lynch's work in general, is the mundane becoming so important. And so saying that this kind of, you know, just ordinary person in the Pacific Northwest, you know, was given this role before birth, It's just like, I just like it when it's, I just, you know, I like it when it's, she's just a normal person. And then it just so happens that all of these forces have collided. But I, again, it's like, I don't, at least I hope that's not where this is heading.
How would you feel if she had mitochlorians, Nathan?
Oh, I think I would be into that. You know, I, there's magic to science too. You know, science explaining the force doesn't ruin the force for me. So
one thing I should say is that it is also entirely possible that we won't ever really return to this aspect of the show. I mean, you know, I tweeted afterwards, you know, I try to not play it blue on here. That's more for my Twitter account, but I did tweet afterwards that next week's episode would primarily center on Dougie Jones learning how to produce cum. And that, I mean, it seems entirely possible that next week's episode will just be that, or him, you know, pissing his pants all over the office or something. I mean, I don't know. Will we actually revisit this in a serious way? I don't know. Maybe, but I don't know. I think it would be satisfying if that aspect of the show kind of either stopped here. Well, yeah, when I say that aspect, I don't mean the whole more avant-garde experimental. I mean just this kind of narrative trajectory. If this was kind of the ground we get, and from that we can sort of draw our own conclusions and assumptions, because I think my ambivalence is more about where it could go than where it actually has gone, you know? Because it's not as if anything is really definitively stated in this. It's just kind of what it's glancing towards, gesturing towards.
And it does. And it does feel like every episode seems to really quell the questions that people have after the previous episode. You know, it seemed like last week's episode was pretty obvious in remedying the kind of the hesitance people were having about the length of the Dougie Jones arc, and then this being such a 180 from the plotting of the week before. I think I'm definitely still confident in Team Lynch and Frost.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
Those questions just always come up, I guess, and then are always redirected.
It's funny, Nathan. Have you read Mark Frost's The Secret History of Twin Peaks?
No, I have. I have not. Other than what I've heard of you breaking it down on the podcast.
I don't think Ethan and I have really talked about this, but there's quite a lot with regards to nuclear testing in the book. But it's one of those weird things where it's present, but it's not necessarily underlined.
Mm-hmm.
But having read it in October, when, you know, we didn't even know when the show was coming back, it was one of those things where it just kind of kept, it was in the back of my mind through some of these early episodes, thinking, are we getting hints towards this? And then pretty much as soon as we saw the date and the location, I thought, oh, fuck, here it is. And then we get, and it's interesting to see how it's kind of not necessarily coming back to that, but because the book was written after the series, the book is kind of finding its place in that mythology. But there's also a lot in that book that, frankly, just hasn't really come up in this new series. Nothing yet with Richard Nixon showing Doug Milford and Jackie Gleason. And that's literally a scene in the book. I'm not joking. Literally a scene in the book.
Oh, my gosh.
Also, Aleister Crowley appears in it as well. And he was connected to Black Lodge, to probably nobody's surprise. I mean, Lynch also claims he has not read the book, so which I find kind of tickling. I like the book a lot, but the idea that his response to having to being asked if he read it was, it's his secret history. That was kind of his last word on it, at least for now. One thing I wanted to ask, I might be outing myself even more as a total idiot when I ask this, but do you think there's a chance, even 20% chance, that this episode was maybe not meant to be structured the way it was not originally meant to be structured the way it plays out? Because I found myself thinking that everything from the beginning through the Nine Inch Nails performance would make for a great end to an episode, because it would be
this big cliffhanger as to, oh my God, Alpha Coop has perhaps been killed, but then the black suit men show up in droves and sort of repair him, and then we have this Nine Inch Nails performance, and then it is this hard cut to 1945. I found myself thinking about it, I think, only because the structure of this has been remarked upon so often, how it was written as one thing, it was shot as one thing, and it was being cobbled together in hour-long segments in the editing room. I don't know. I'm wondering if that thought crossed your mind, well, either.
The fact that this is, we should mention, there's no new episode next week because of the July 4th holiday. It does make me wonder if it was, at least the airing was structured to have this be the last episode before the week-long break, so it kind of left everyone on this, you know, gave everyone something to talk about for 2 weeks. Maybe the show to gain a second wave of buzz.
I was almost wondering, maybe this is a little bit too into kind of some kind of fan theory nonsense, but I almost felt like structurally it was kind of like in the Black Lodge, like Lynch was talking backwards, just by placing, like you said, not just the concert, you know, performance, but the other parts of, you know, the other scenes around that really do feel like the end of an episode. So placing that at the beginning, I don't know, it felt like the whole show itself was very literally structurally in the lodge. That was kind of, after rewatching it the second time, that was kind of the thought that crossed my mind, honestly. But I also was thinking too about how, wondering how deliberate the choice to have this before the break was, just because I think the show so far has done a really a good job of exploiting whatever is left of water cooler TV culture, and it I don't know, it has provided conversation for the next week and done a very good job of that, which, I mean, that's, you know, a lot of people have commented on how this plays off of the ideas of prestige TV and whatnot, but I have to assume at least that placing this episode at this time with its structure feels intentional.
Perhaps, yeah. I don't think Lynch knows about or really gives a shit about the concept of prestige TV, though.
Yeah, oh, I know. I think it's definitely just one of those things that everyone has gone looking for. But I really can't, I don't know, in the first couple of episodes, the suburb, the Rancho Rosa suburb, just looks so much like the neighborhood from Breaking Bad that I, like, can't. Stop thinking about that. And that also, like, Breaking Bad.
Of which he is a fan.
Breaking Bad was the last show that I watched from week to week. The final season was the last show that I ever did that with. Like, and this is the first since then, so.
Also, I think Dougie and Sonny Jim is definitely a reference to Colin Farrell and his son from True Detective Season 2.
I hope so. I feel like Lynch would be a... The only thing that maybe he's seen in the past 3 years would be True Detective Season 2.
Hopefully. Well, Nathan, before we go, I do want to ask you, what do you think of John Cena apparently being a Twin Peaks fan?
Well, it's funny that I mentioned Prometheus then, since he's also a huge Prometheus fan. Mm-hmm. I am both... baffled and delighted, but also in one sense not really surprised for some reason. I can just, you know, I don't know, just something about it just seems very right that someone as seemingly well-adjusted and loving and, you know, all-American as John Cena can get down with the weirdest of Lynch.
Before we jet out, could we maybe just briefly talk about the whole resurrection resuscitation from the Black Lodge sequence, because I thought that was that was maybe my favorite part of the episode. And you know, I know that I've sort of been comparing this season to cinema in a way, but watching this, I mean, I again thought of Olivera. If I'm thinking of it this much, there's got to be some connection, I swear to God. But very, I mean, this is a very like strange case of Angelica, the Phantom, appearing kind of in this very pastoral setting. I also kind of thought of Raul Ruiz a bit, and also Lake Coppola, too, although I don't think David Lynch has seen Twixt. The odds of that seem a little low.
I think there's a better chance of him having seen Twixt than any Olivier or Ruiz film, honestly.
I was going to say Bruce Dern, Laura's father, is in Twixt, so there's actually a decent enough chance of it. But yeah, the whole layering of the whole stacking of the dancing figures on top of an otherwise more traditionally shot and cut scene was just I live and die for that kind of thing.
We didn't even talk about the bug at all. The bird flappy guy.
Man, is it Laura? Is it Bob?
That would be great if it was Laura, and if she were actually just the whole time this like weird reptilian being from another world. I'd be so into that.
Yeah, I think I'd, of all the possible explanations, that's probably the one that gets me the most. But I don't know. Yeah, Ethan, I could pretty much, from Brooklyn, I could pretty much hear you yell, "Oh, hell yeah," when they said the Nine Inch Nails, so.
I wanted to mention, too, didn't the host, didn't he look a lot like the late Jimmy Scott?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'd forgotten that Jimmy Scott died, because for a second I thought, oh my God, they brought him back. And then after a second I realized, no, he's dead.
And serious props to the Roadhouse for booking them. That's a pretty big get.
They need the spinoff just about like the behind the scenes booking drama at the Roadhouse. It's nice because
Have you been watching I'm Dying Up Here, which immediately follows physics?
I am really liked the Nine Inch Nails performance, mostly because I felt like everything up to this point has been a little too Riverdale. As much as I love Riverdale, you know, I need distinction between my dark small town universes. So I appreciate that they, you know, went in the total opposite direction from the kind of the sad synths and saxes that Lynch loves. So.
Can you imagine if that performance was Eddie Vedder instead?
I hope that Eddie Vedder is doing his solo ukulele project. I hope that's what it is. I can't imagine it would be anything else.
I hope he just does Jeremy.
I'm hoping. Here's the thing. So Nine Inch Nails exists in the Twin Peaks universe, which is kind of crazy, because when it's Chromatics, it's not necessarily in, you know, strict terms Chromatics. It's not necessarily Sharon Van Etten. I absolutely, for the life of me, do not remember who the other musical performances were. What was one of them called?
Au Revoir, something. Simone.
Like Trouble or something?
Yeah,
like
Lynch's Sons Band.
Yeah. So, because the thing is, they're credited just as themselves, but this plays along with their identity with the whole quote-unquote the. So Nine Inch Nails exists in the Twin Peaks universe, which is very curious.
But does I'm Afraid of Americans exist within the Twin Peaks universe if David Bowie doesn't exist?
Right, that's true. Well, I mean, that was a Trent Reznor endeavor, not a Nine Inch Nails endeavor. True. Right? Also, let's not forget that I'm Afraid of Americans premiered in what film, gentlemen?
Showgirls, as Showgirls. I'm Afraid of the Animals.
Yes, that's right.
So, yeah.
So there is a bit of a...
Does Nomi Malone exist in the Twin Peaks universe, then?
We're through the looking glass here, people.
Does this mean that perhaps Tom Showgirls is Alpha Coop?
that's just what I was thinking. That suit, yeah. You know, it would work.
Mm.
It's all come together.
Wow. Oh. Good job, boys. You really did some detective work this week. Nathan, where can we find you on the internet?
I am mostly on Twitter at Trillmore Girls. Like oh, yeah. I said I wasn't a TV person, and my damn Twitter handle is a TV show reference. I feel awful now. So yeah, I'm mostly there. You can find the various writing and endeavors that I do there. I also have a website. That is my full name, NathanEskerSmith.weebly.com. So you can also look at things that I do there. Yeah, that's about it. Spend all my time tweeting.
Hell yeah. Who does? Nathan's one of my favorite people on Twitter, so make sure to follow him.
Ethan is also my favorite people, so you should follow him too. Yeah. Sometimes I tweet tweets only for Ethan. So.
Yeah, there have been cases. Yeah. Nick, what about you? Where can we find you on the internet?
Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, The Film Stage, and Grasshopper Film.
Well, thank you both. That was certainly a hell of an episode of television, and we still have more than half left. So look forward to more of these.